Raycash, a community advocate and law student on unceded Algonquin territory at the University of Ottawa.
My name is Kim Pate, and I have the privilege and responsibility of being a senator in unceded, unsurrendered Algonquin Anishinaabeg territory.
And you're listening to Appointed. So on this episode of Appointed, we're talking about vulnerable kids in care. And one thing that kept coming up, something that was a common thread throughout this episode, is the legal concept of best interest of the child. And I remember learning about this term in family law, and it really kind of seemed like a nebulous term that hadn't necessarily been tied down. And so I found the Canadian Bar Association's definition. And their definition is children have less possibility than adults to make a strong case for their own interests, so those involved in decisions affecting a child must be explicitly aware of the child's interests. And we also know that in Article 3.1 of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, it states that in all actions concerning children, whether undertaken by public or private social welfare institutions, courts of law, administrative authorities, or legislative bodies, the best interests of the child shall be a primary consideration. So the best interest of the child is supposed to be both a substantive right and a guiding principle that is aimed at the child's holistic development and promotes the child's human dignity. And when we're thinking about best interest of the child, an adult's judgment is not supposed to override the child's right. But, you know, unfortunately, it doesn't really seem to me like this concept is always followed. We know that often children in foster care systems are bounced from home to home for reasons that, you know, seem to have little to do with the children and their children's needs. And we also know that multiple children who have come to Canada, who were migrants or refugees, their needs were not taken care of in terms of their Canadian citizenship was not confirmed. And in cases like Abdullahi Elmi, because his citizenship was not confirmed, he was at risk of deportation. And that's a common thread for many other migrant children who are in care. So all of that to say, Kim, what do you think about this concept of best interest of the child? And do you think that this concept is really meted out in an honest way, in an effective way?
Well, I think it depends on who's involved and whose definition, because by its very nature, although there are definitions of best interests of the child, and when you say it, everybody says, of course, that's where we go. The context is vitally important. So no children appear without, you know, they're not beings that just drop from another planet and land plop in the child welfare system or through the immigration process or any of this. Almost always they come attached to, at the very least, a mother and often others. And so the best interest of the child has to be also looked at within the context of what exists, or more to the point, what doesn't exist in the communities, so whether it's family of origin or the family or community of support in which they are. And so I think it's really important to look at what does that mean, centering on the child in that context and within the context of how does whatever is done to intervene actually further the interests of that child to having not just their basic needs met, but assisting them to grow and develop and be part of their communities. But I've seen, you know, just in the past couple of months, the work that's being done on trying to ensure those kids who come into the country as children and as refugees or as immigrants with their families, who then end up in the care of the state through obviously no fault of their own. There never is the fault of the child if they end up in the care of the state. If they end up in the care of the state and you end up in foster care or group homes, you're often in similar or the same settings as individuals who are criminalized. As well, if you do behavior that often in a family is seen as part of growing up, you know, sometimes being a bit belligerent, challenging authority, maybe even sometimes, you know, hitting a wall or that sort of thing. All of those in a home, in a family situation, are unlikely to result in someone being criminalized, but in a foster or group home situation can. And so we've seen many young people who it's a direct path almost from the child welfare system into the juvenile system, into the adult system. And then if the state, who has become their parent by taking them into care, doesn't fulfill the parental obligation of obtaining citizenship for that child, then the state can kick that child out in terms of ejecting them and having the young person or the young adult face deportation. And I think there are moves to interrupt that. Well, not I think. I know there are moves because we've worked on legislation. We've consulted with the folks who've experienced this and who one by one have been plucked out of the system. We've talked to folks who have not been able to be removed from the system, who have been removed from the country. We've talked to those lawyers and academics who've worked on this. And we've also talked to judges and folks who are interested in these issues. And so I think there are a couple of ways we could be moving forward for those who are facing, you know, who are being dumped out of care as they age out of care. There are all kinds of issues around the need for supports as they leave care, because unlike most young people these days, if they're in a family situation, when they're 18, they're not automatically kicked to the curb and told that they no longer have any support from their family or community, but kids in care often are. Even though there are many great people working in the system who still extend a hand, there is no formal state requirement that that continue. There are those young people who are facing immigration challenges and potentially deportation. And we need to be intervening much earlier. One example of a really, I thought, an innovative way of intervening earlier in ways that support parents, particularly moms who are facing challenges with kids, instead of taking kids out of care, Nelson House, apparently there, the community has worked together with the courts. And if a young person is deemed to be in a situation where they're deemed to be in need of care, in the best interests of the child, what they have argued, which I think is an incredibly creative argument, is to say, rather than take the child out of the home gets designated as the placement, whether it's a foster care placement or the temporary placement for the young person. And the parents are taken out, with support of the community, parents are taken out. And the focus is first and foremost on having kin or family members or kin who can come in. And they're not then asked to just do it off, you know, out of the goodness of their hearts. They're actually funded to provide that support. And oftentimes we know if, in fact, the supports are in place before these events, families never even have to get to this stage. But many of the folks we're talking about are living in poverty. So the resources are injected into that home. And all focus is on trying as best as possible, as soon as it is feasible and in the best interests of the child, from the child and the community's perspective, to have those family members back, the parents back, then they move back into and are integrated back into that home. So the foster home or group home placement, if you will, is not a separate place, but is the place where the child lives and all supports and resources are built around the child in that setting. We don't need to look any further than the forced removal of children through residential schools and the following interventions and all of the issues around the numbers of young people, particularly poor kids, racialized kids, who end up in the foster child welfare and then often the juvenile and prison system, to know the impact of not investing first and foremost in children early and in an ongoing way that encourages them to not just have their basic needs met, but to be able to reach their full potential.
Absolutely. I'm excited to hear from our guests and find out what their experiences have been working in the child welfare system and being affected in their lives by the child welfare system, and hopefully sort of reflecting on how we can create something that's better and amplify some of the examples that you've provided of strategies that work better to keep children safe, but also prevent that separation from their family. Natasha is Indigenous and Caribbean and spent most of her life bouncing around different group and foster homes. She graduated from the University of Winnipeg in 2019 with a Bachelor of Arts degree, majoring in criminal justice and minoring in sociology and conflict resolution studies. Natasha founded the peer support group called Foster Up in Winnipeg for youth who are aging out of the foster care system and trying to navigate post-secondary education. Natasha is a survivor of the millennial scoop, which is the ongoing assimilation of Indigenous children and youth through the Canadian government's child welfare systems. Natasha told her story through a podcast called The Disappearance of Natasha Lynn Starr. Her podcast is linked in the show notes, and you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. My first question for you, Natasha, is how old were you when you entered the foster care system in Manitoba?
I first entered the foster care system in Manitoba around the age of one. Mm-hmm. And then I bounced between my foster home and my mom's place. And then I finally was adopted out around the age of four.
Okay. So you created an incredible podcast called The Disappearance of Natasha Lynn Starr. I love it. I devoured it in like a day. And one of the things I'm wondering is how hard was it for you to reveal some of these really vulnerable parts of your childhood and what it was like growing up as a child in the system? Why did you decide to document your story in podcast form? And what was it like going through that process?
Well, thank you for listening to the podcast. I really appreciate that. I chose to share my story through that format. I was contacted by APTN and they offered me an opportunity, an internship for the summer to write about foster care. And I decided to share my story because I didn't want to speak for all kids in care. And I thought it would help me on my healing journey, which it definitely did. It was hard at times because I had to revisit painful parts of my life. But through it all, I found a lot of healing happen through that writing process, through the recording process. And I guess what I had to tell myself was that, yes, the past did hurt, but it can't hurt me anymore. And that was kind of what I talked to myself about when I was writing it. I did make sure to like talk to people because I was visiting very traumatic parts of my life. So I was very supported through that journey. And I was writing in an environment where I was very, very, very supported and never pushed to say, talk about things I didn't want to talk about. So it was a very safe and respectful environment. And I'm so grateful that I was able to share my story.
So on the podcast, you talk about the fact that because you were in foster care and you were in the system, you were being raised by folks who practice more Western religions. And you were then separated from, and you were unable to engage with some of your traditional practices. Can you explain what it was like to return back to some of those Cree practices or Jamaican practices that you didn't have the opportunity to engage with growing up?
So growing up, I never knew what my ethnicity was. I was always told that I was a mix of something, but they never told me my adopted parents, no one ever told me who I was or what ethnicity my parents were. So when I turned, oh, I think it was around 19, 20-ish, I decided to ask for my file from my social worker and all the information pertaining about my parents' like identity, like their race and that kind of stuff was all blocked out. So I was like extremely frustrated with that whole situation because I had waited so long to get answers, and I was told when I was an adult I would get the answers, but then when I turned of age, I didn't get the answers at all. So it was a very frustrating experience. So I ended up contacting my adopted mother, as I said in my podcast, and I asked just for like if she had any hunches of any names, and from there I just went on social media and I ended up finding my family through Facebook. So yeah, and that's kind of how I found them.
So on the podcast, you talk a lot about this term, the best interest of the child, and how that term affected you and how you understand that term. Can you share with us what the best interest of the child means to you and in your life?
I feel like the best interest of a child definition, that word, whatever, is like a one size fits all. And it fails to recognize that they are different interests for different kind of children, from children from different races, from children with, yeah, everyone's different. And I often find, like I found growing up, that the best interests of a child, what was in my best interests, were often overlooked. Like, I don't understand to this day, like how multiple different high schools, all that was in my best interest. All those changes were my best interest, how those were all my best interests at that time in my life. But the system claims that they're acting my best interest. So that's where I always get stuck, is like, was it my best interest? Because I didn't want to move. There were times where I didn't want to move. There were times where I wanted to stay.
I think it also comes true and is a bit confounding, hard to understand, how the best interest of the child played in to the decision to separate you from your siblings and from your twin sisters. Do you ever think about how that separation could have possibly been in your best interest?
I don't think that ever was in my best interest, being separated from my siblings, actually. I think that was just cruel, actually. I think it was a very cruel thing to do.
Yeah.
And I don't know why. I was only two. The twins were one. They separated even the twins at one point, too. But they brought them back together. Wow. And when they separated us, the social worker at the time would have known that we would have never been in contact again. And I think, I don't know, part of me thinks that they thought that he'd be fine. She's a kid. She's not going to notice. But I did. You know, growing up with no one that looks like you. And then when I met my twin sisters and looking at them, they look exactly like me. And it was cool to meet people who looked exactly like me, but also kind of painful to think about when I do think about it, when I do think about what happened. And essentially, we're strangers. Like we have a relationship now, and we're slowly getting integrated back into each other's lives. But it's just, once again, I have to pick up the pieces of a mess that I didn't create, and it's frustrating because that relationship with my sisters shouldn't have ever been taken away from me, but it was.
Indigenous children make up more than 50% of all children under the age of 5 in foster care. Yet, only 8% of Canada's population aged 4 and under are Indigenous. In 2016, a Canadian Human Rights Tribunal ruled the Canadian government was discriminating against Indigenous children. Because on-reserve communities are not afforded the same level of resources for their families as other communities. As a consequence, more Indigenous children are likely to end up separated from their families in foster care, group homes, or detention facilities than non-Indigenous children. In Manitoba, for example, 10,000 of the 11,000 children in care are Indigenous. In Alberta, about 70% of children in foster care are Indigenous. And although there is not much published research on the disproportionate representation of Black children in the Canadian child welfare system, the Ontario Human Rights Commission confirms that in Ontario, it's clear that Black children are overrepresented in the child welfare system relative to their presence in the child population. The federal government introduced new legislation that came into force on January 1st of 2020. It's called the Act Respecting First Nations, Inuit, and Métis Children, Youth, and Families. The stated purpose of this new legislation is to reduce the number of Indigenous children and youth in care and improve child and family services. Keep an eye on this act. Hopefully, it's less harmful to children like Natasha than past federal legislation has been, and instead offers opportunities for healing. Dunya Nur is a Somali Canadian from Edmonton, Alberta. She has a dual degree in social work and Bachelor of Child and Youth Care. Her areas of expertise include maternal, child, and reproductive health, mental health, child migrants, and pre-migration trauma. Dunya is one of the primary advocates for Abdullahi Elmi and many others like him. Elmi is a former Somali child refugee who was released from detention in Edmonton after advocates and the United Nations successfully pressured Canada to stay his removal from the country. I just want to start by talking about your work with the African Canadian Civic Engagement Council. Can you tell me about that organization and the work that you folks do?
Yeah, the African Canadian Civic Engagement Council is an organization that's based in Edmonton, Alberta. It's a nonprofit organization, youth-led, youth-found, and our vision and mandate is to ensure that all African Canadians are receiving the best of adequate care and quality of life and protection for all types of human rights, including extending it to all communities and all of society at large.
So there's one youth that you worked with. His name is Abdullahi Elmi, and he was born in Somalia. He was separated from his parents during the war and raised by his grandmother in a refugee camp. And at 10 years old, Abdullahi was reunited with his mother in Toronto, but after just 3 years, he was placed in foster care. Now, by the time Abdullahi was 16, he was living rough and sleeping on the streets. But we know that while Abdullahi was in government care, Children's Aid failed to take the proper steps to secure his permanent residency status. Abdullahi committed a criminalized act and served a jail sentence in 2018. And after serving his sentence, CBSA ordered Abdullahi to be deported to Somalia. We know that at 34, Abdullahi was at risk of being sent to a country he had not lived in for more than 14 years. So yourself and a number of other community members supported Abdullahi and his family during this time. Can you tell me more about what happened when you were asked to support him?
Yeah, definitely. On December 2018, Abdullahi Elmi actually reached out to me and called me from Edmonton Remand Center asking for services and support regarding for community reintegration. He specifically requested for a bail plan. He requested for community support. He requested for me to help him find a lawyer. And that's when he shared his story with me of who he is. And I was the first member of the community that he said he's ever reached out to ever in his life, and that he needed various of different supports to help him stay in Canada. So that's when he shared with me about his life, his background, who he is, where he came from when he came to Canada, and the pressing situation that he was facing in regards to deportation.
So how did you help him after he reached out to you? What was sort of the first thing that you did?
Yeah, so as soon as he reached out to me, I spoke to my board members and presented the case. And to be quite honest, Abdullah Helmi is not like the only case that's like this. We dealt with multiple of cases like Abdullah Helmi's case. The main thing is for us, I sat with my board and I presented them the case and I said, this is what's going on and this is a young man and this is his first time reaching out. So we did have an agreement to move forward and put the best adequate support we can possibly provide him. And to be quite honest, the main objective of even helping him and all the other young, you know, young men and women that we serve is solely for the purpose of the protection of children and adolescents. And a significant consideration that we took into place, like Abdullah Elmi's case, is the core values that all adults, including those who are involved in any type of decision making related to programs, budgets, policies, law, should do what's in the best of interest for children. And one thing that really stood out to us when it came to Abdullah Helmi is his story of adverse childhood, which was very, very clear in what he has shared with the public and what his mom shared with the public as well. So that's one thing that we're like, wow, this is a young person that experienced pre-migration trauma, post-migration trauma, is literally displaced and then, you know, goes into the child welfare system and has no adequate care there as well. And then before you know, he's sleeping in the streets trying to survive and then gets himself building multiple records and then leads to deportation. So for us, it was like a blueprint in terms of what can Canada do better to protect child migrants, refugee and immigrant families.
So what happened between Abdullahi reaching out to you and then the Minister of Immigration intervening? That seems like a huge difference.
Yeah, to be quite honest, personally, I would say we got really lucky. We had incredible support and a whole team that was behind Abdullah and me. Aside from ASAC, we had Al Jones from Nova Scotia that was supporting, who also worked on Abdul Abdi's case. We had Desmond Cole that was supporting us. We had Robin from Toronto. It was just like an incredible team. And one thing that was very fascinating that we've quickly learned from this case is that it's not an isolated incident. I mean, guys always reach out to me in Edmonton Remand Center. And within the same month that Abdullah Helmi reached out to me, actually, 7 guys have been deported. And they all are from, you know, they all have African descent background. So pretty much one thing that we've learned is we need some sort of national strategy. We need to incorporate something that really protects, you know, children, families, and adolescents, particularly women and children. And we have incorporated everything that we could possibly put in place. So as soon as we intervened, what we actually did is we hired a lawyer. The community, the Somali community and the African Canadian Civic Engagement Council have, we put a fundraising strategy and we hired Abdullahi, a senior immigration defense lawyer named Ido from Andrew Law. And he right away was able to get Abdullahi Elmi released. And then as soon as he came to the community, what a lot of people don't know is that there was no sense of institutional support for Abdullah Helmi. So in terms of there was no counseling, there was no housing, there was no food, there was no medical care. And that's what a lot of people don't understand about individuals that are in a limbo when it comes to status issues. So for over like 7 months, we beyond stretched our capacity, and we've been supporting Abdullahi Elmi in terms of food, in terms of shelter, in terms of any type of mental health barriers, and him being a young person living with adverse childhood trauma and addiction, that relapse is part of the recovery. So it was really difficult, and we were very disappointed that it's like, okay, you can stay because now that United Nations intervened, however, you will have no access to support. So it's like, well, how do we expect someone to survive when they have no house, when they can't go on Alberta Works, when they can't go to school, when they have no SIN number, when they can't get employed? So literally, aunties who they themselves are living in a poverty rate would take money together, elders from our community and members of ASAC, and we would literally just put money together just so he can have food and roof over his head. And that's the best that we can do. Mm. And that was a really tough case. So the only response that we got from the immigration, the Minister of Immigration, is after UN intervened, and the statement of, now we'll cancel the deportation until further assessment is completed.
Yeah, so I think from an external perspective, from people who are in community and maybe shared his story, maybe shared GoFundMes and donated, I think all that folks see is, oh, great, he's not going to be deported now. But we don't really think about, one, the other individuals who actually did get deported, who were in his similar situation that you brought up, and two, what happens to folks after they are told, sure, you can stay in Canada, but they're not offered a way to go back to school, they're not offered healthcare, they're not offered addiction supports, they're not offered housing, and then what happens?
Of course, then what happens is it's pretty much, it's a setup. That's what I would call it. It's a setup for failure, because what we're doing is we're taking away the basic, necessities for a person to survive. And just because, members of society, our community, our advocates, our educators, especially the legal team of University of Toronto played a significant role in assisting Elmi's case. But just because he had a strong support that advocated for him, which resulted to him staying, now what? Right? Now what is that he can't even open a bank because the bank requires an ID. He doesn't have an ID because the ID requires, so it's like it becomes a very tricky situation that is kind of like, well, it's a good thing, and we're always thankful that Canada, canceled the deportation. But at the same time, it's a great setup for failure. So it makes me think of, how about the other children? How about the other women and men that are put in this situation that don't have community advocates and support? And it's a very tough line. It's something that definitely requires a conversation, community development, and legislative and policy change. That's definitely for sure.
So Abdullahi Elmi's case has a lot in common with another case that I'm sure our listeners are familiar with, and that's Abdul Abdi's case. So Abdul was also a Somali child refugee to Canada who faced deportation from Canada as an adult. And again, Abdul grew up in foster care, but Nova Scotia's Children Aid failed to secure citizenship for him while he was in care. So this strikes me as a systemic issue. What is going on with our children? Why do Canadian social and legal systems continue to fail them?
Well, I think it's a couple of things, in my personal opinion. I think it's the lack of understanding what families need once they arrive in Canada. I also think that there's a institutional, how I personally see, especially a lot of the youth that reach out to me. I was supervising RAPID, which was a federal pilot project funded by the Government of Canada for gang reduction and helping, specifically youth from African immigrant refugee communities and First Nations youth. And one thing that I realize is that always everything starts systemically. So when there is a lot of and discrimination systemically, when there is no access to opportunities systemically, when a child has to die for programs or policies to even be changed, you know, it really makes you think about, we look at things from the aftermath. We look at these young men from, you know, oh, they've committed crime. But what a lot of people don't understand is all of their crimes started with, you know, parents facing extreme stress and depression, parents facing intensive trauma, being literally discriminated and expelled and suspended from school at a very young age, not being in any type of recreational activities, not having mentors that these young people can reach out to, the streets mentoring them. And when they get hungry, drug dealers being available to them. So I feel like there's a lot of criminalization around mental health. There's criminalization around poverty, but yet it's systemically and institutionally created. And that's the true conversation that we need to have. What's happening in our schools? What's happening in the workforce? What's happening in the housing development? Why are certain communities being targeted? So one thing that I could say specifically, even when I was supervising RAPID, is all of my youth that were from our African descent, they came from Somalia, they came from South Sudan, Liberia, Congo, Ethiopia, Eritrea. They came from so many different countries, but particularly those seven countries. And when we did a cross analysis in terms of where are these youth from, they were the ones that had labels of danger to public. They were the ones that had deportation cases. They were the ones that were serving in EYOC and naturally got a transition to Edmonton Remand Center from a youth offense, from a youth offender center to an adult remand center. So what do they have in common? And what we did is I started collecting stories. The first thing I said is, tell me your story. I don't know who you are. What was shocking, but not surprising, is that they all lived in a refugee camp.
Wow.
They all were exposed to violence and trauma, and they've seen dead bodies. That they all had some sort of loss and grief, that they were victims of violence. At the same time, what was very alarming is each one of my youth that I visited in you know, the Young Youth Offender Center in Edmonton, they all were expelled and suspended from school during I believe it was grade three. Expulsion and suspension started at grade three. And then, you know, harsher punitive punishments started during their time in junior high. And then by the time high school, none of my guys have a high school diploma. And for me, it was like, okay, so you see the pattern and their life trajectory of how they get to where they get to now, right? Many of the moms, another commonality is all of their moms didn't know how to speak English. Most of them were domestic violence survivors. So, I mean, when we put something on the newspaper of here's an offender, danger to the public, what we don't understand is what is our definition of public safety? Because my definition of public safety, you know, and this is where I trace my cultural lineage as an African Canadian, is it takes a village to raise a child. So who are those villages that are surrounding these young children? And who are the, and what are the risk factors that are making these children susceptible to harm? And one of the significant risk factors that we have end up finding in our analysis is institutions like school. Many institutions like child welfare, institutions like racial profiling and being targeted and carding, those are the situations that, you know, bring these young men into these type of situations. Now, why is that important? Because a lot of, and this is where the legal justice system comes into place, a lot of our young men and women end up hiring lawyers that will just take on the criminal case, but will not even explain to them or will not even ask them, what is your status in Canada?
Right.
And because what they don't understand is once they plead guilty to example, you know, theft under 5,000, theft under 5,000, and then maybe it's their third time, and then they serve, you know, okay, let me teach this youth a lesson so he doesn't do it again, and then they serve a sentence for 6 months and more. What they don't understand is within, you know, the Canadian Immigration Department, you will be deported. So even lawyers are not explaining that. So I had a guy that called me like 3 months ago, and he said, I'm 45 years old. I've committed a lot of things, a lot of crime, and my lawyer did not explain to me. And I think I'm going to be deported. Can you help me? And I'm like, well, I'm not too sure how to help you or how to support you. I mean, I recommended him to a lawyer. But these are the stuff that it's just so complex. But yet sometimes also the strategies is very simple. It's to raise a child and see a child as a child and to not deprive a child from their childhood.
I mean, on one hand, it kind of strikes me that it's lawyers' responsibility to understand the entirety of their client's situation and make sure that whatever criminal legal strategies they have, that they're effective and they help this young person meet their goals. And that strikes me as, you know, a problem that in our legal field we have to take responsibility for. You know, a few days ago you reached out to me about a young person named Junior. Do you think you can tell me a bit about his case and where we're at?
Yes, Junior's case is a very unfortunate case. He's a young man that I've been working with for the past 2 years, who really came a long way, and his background, his mother is from Ivory Coast, and his dad is from Congo. And what happened with Junior is that from a very young age, he's faced like substantial difficulties. He experienced so much deep-rooted trauma. He, you know, he's done a lot of things to survive due to extreme poverty. And honestly, despite the challenges that he's faced, I actually met Junior. He was referred to me by his probation officer for community reintegration and rehabilitation. So I met it, the first time I met him, I met a sad kid. I met a kid that was very like confused and emotional. And I never knew what was going on with him because he was just referred to me for him to complete a 40-hour community service. And then after building rapport, trust-based intervention relationships, you know, integrating him to the community, taking him to a lot of cultural events like Africa Center's cultural events and you know, particularly YEG, the come up, like for him to have some sort of like youth exposure and where he's from. And he was just mind blown. He was like, wow, this is who I am. And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, you know, Junior, I really want to continue working with the African Canadian Civic Engagement Council. And I want you to stay in my, as a long-term support in my life. And I'm like, that's fine. We have a lot of youth that we follow up with. But may I ask what makes you say that? And he said, because I have a deportation case. I have an immigration case. And I don't even know half of the words that is being used to describe me, or am I going to be deported? And then when he showed me his papers, I'm like, oh my God, this is really serious. Do you have a lawyer? And his question was, how do I even hire a lawyer?
Mm-hmm.
And this is when I met him when he was 16 years old. So I have a 16 years old kid thinking about what food should I eat? How should I respond to immigration? I finish my community service hours so I don't breach and go back, like go to EYOC. And at the same time, how do I feed my younger brother who's waiting for me at home? So it was just really sad to see his story. And I mean, there's so many other things that he went through that due to confidentiality, I definitely cannot disclose. But he is the prime example of what resiliency looks like. He is an incredible, intelligent, artistic, sensitive young man. And his whole life, he literally came to Canada at the age of 3, Montreal, and then his family moved to Edmonton, and he's been raised in Canada. Canada's all he knows. So he's like, the first question he asked me is, so Junior, if the government of Canada deports me, where will they drop me off? And I said, where are they saying that you were born? And he said, well, I was always told I was born in Congo, but I just found out I was born in New York. And yeah, they will drop you off in the airport. And as soon as you land, they will leave you. He's like, so who do I call? I'm like, that's a good question. Do you have any family, any community, any supports? He's like, no. And I remember just him, like the look he gave me. And he's one of those young, you know, he's one of those young people that really are just so resilient that they will never like show you how scared they are. But for the first time ever, he actually came to me. And he's like, thank you for helping me. And he walked away and then he called me. And this is the first time ever. He said, Dunya, I'm scared. And that just broke my heart. I'm like, at the age of 16, 17, you should be in recreation. You should be playing hockey or basketball. You should enjoy music. You should continue receiving programs from iHuman and, you know, the African Canadian Civic Engagement Council and Africa Center. And you should be a kid. You should not be worried about what your mom's going to eat, how you're going to feed your younger brother, how you're going to respond to immigration, how you're going to hire a lawyer. Like, just think about the mental health. Think about what that does to a child. It completely took away his whole childhood. So we have, and I mean, again, this is like when I look at Junior, it was literally the situation that Elmi was in the first time, as soon as Elmi was out of the government care at the age of 18, is the same situation that Junior is in right now. And then, so now what we're saying is, well, let's intervene for Junior at a very young age, because rehabilitation, reintegration, responding to treatment, you know, all of that, of course, the success rate is a lot more higher when you're young. I mean, clearly it's high as well when you're older, but there's a lot of barriers and hiccups, and you'd have to relapse 7 times for you to even recover. We know that through research. So it's just amazing how now we're working with youth in schools in grade 3, 4, and 5, and we sit in their expulsion suspension hearing for them to not be expelled like Junior was. And then we are sitting and working with Junior so he doesn't end up like how Elmi did. And then we've tried to help Elmi and put so many things in place for Elmi just so he doesn't get deported and have his life at risk, like those other 7, 8 young men that called me from Edmonton remand, you know, a year ago. So it's just amazing how all of their lives just interconnects and their stories seem so different, but yet it's like very similar narrative.
I found Natasha's story really challenging because both of us listened to her podcast. I also recommend everyone take a listen to Natasha's podcast. We'll put the link to the podcast again in the show notes. But one thing that I just can't understand, wrap my head around, is how separating Natasha from her twin sisters could possibly have been in her best interests or in her sister's best interests. I'm wondering if you have reflections about that.
Oh, I agree. How, you know, you hear in, I can't, the graphic, heartbreaking stories of that she tells that are her life experiences and the life experiences of her sisters and her family, just the long-term, permanent, devastating impact of those kinds of decisions. And, you know, I don't even know who could define that is in any one of those children's best interests. So I hope that it causes all of us to rethink the ways that we're doing things and to think about some of the creative options, like what they're doing in Norway House, like providing supports early, right away for those, for families when they're looking for it. I mean, I often think of when I had my own kids. When I had my son, who's 29, a public health nurse visited every single one of us. And the conversations she and I had were, you know, I put too many pillows around because I didn't like my kid looking through bars, and she just recommended I take him out of the crib. So I did that. It's pretty easy. But we also talked about the number of people she visited who really wanted more support. And you know, when we first have children, we all, well, maybe I'm, projecting here, but I suspect we all feel the enormity of that responsibility of suddenly having a child there, and we all want help, and we all need varying levels and degrees of assistance, and we're all reaching out for it, but virtually no help is there for many, far too many moms and young parents who are looking for that help. And I think we need to rethink our system so that we privilege the resources that start there. The old Perry preschool research that was done in the States that showed that for every dollar you invest in a young child from infancy to age 5, you save $7 in healthcare costs, child welfare costs, and prison costs, and the criminal legal system costs. And I think we need to reinvest early and often in young people, in those who are the most dispossessed and those who are most marginalized, and look at where those intersections collide and privilege those areas for developing supports and resources.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Appointed. Before you go, I just want to thank you for tuning in and engaging with our podcast over the last year or so. I helped Senator Pate start this podcast while I was working in her office during law school, but I've just completed law school and am moving on to other more full-time projects. I've learned and grown so much through Appointed. So thank you for being part of my journey. Feel free to follow me on Twitter at Raekash, that's at R-E-A-K-A-S-H, to continue our conversations. And don't worry, the podcast continues, and you'll be in very good hands. Until next time.